Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the morning show also comes from Carthage College, inviting you to become part of the studio audience for the last Beyond the Beltway nationally syndicated radio broadcast that will air before the election. The program, hosted by Bruce Dumont, will be produced at the Neiman Media Theater at Carthage this Sunday night. Email rsvp at carthage.edu if you would like to attend. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD-HD. I'm Gregory Berg. Exuberant music is by the great American composer Libby Larson, Perry Spring from her song cycle, My Antonia. It's one of the works by Libby Larson I know best and love the most, but there are all kinds of works, more than 400, that Libby Larson has composed over the last several decades. She is among America's most esteemed and most often performed composers. And Carthage College is certainly privileged to have her on campus right now this week as the very, very special guest of Carthage's 14th annual Lakeside Band Festival, an event which will culminate with an exciting concert this Saturday night at Siebert Chapel. And joining me here in the studios, first of all, is the person primarily hosting Libby Larson this week at Carthage, Dr. James Ripley, who is the Director of Instrumental Activities at Carthage. And we have with us in the studio as well, I am thrilled to say, composer Libby Larson herself. We welcome both of you to the morning show.
Good morning, Greg.
Good morning.
Good to have you here. It's great to have you here. Dr. Ripley, tell us how this great composer can be sitting here this morning and be at Carthage this week. How did such a momentous thing happen?
Well, it's certainly a collaborative effort that has brought this to be. The first thing was that the band festival, as you indicated, has been going on for 14 years, and we've had great connections with various composers around the world. Actually, last year we had Ralph Hultgren here from Australia. We've had Johann de Meij from the Netherlands, and it was time to get somebody back from the United States. And I've known Libby's music for almost as long as I've been teaching. And a piece of music that was commissioned by Rick Hansen called The Grand Rondo kind of got me started in listening to her music. And I just knew that this was the time that we could bring her, and especially with our voice faculty being so supportive about collaborating and putting all of this together. So it was really bringing a composer of international reputation to the college for everybody.
Wow. So the two of you just met yesterday for the first time?
Yep.
So all you knew her music, but not her?
Correct.
Yep. And you know her now?
Yeah. Well, happily so.
Well, Libby Larson, it's great to welcome you here to the program. And I'm just thinking, as Dr. Ripley was saying, when it comes to an American composer, you're about as American as it gets in the sense of, although you were born in Delaware, you grew up and still live in Minnesota. So right in the heartland of the United States.
Right next door.
And I suspect that you feel like that's a very important part of who you are as a composer.
You know, I do. I often think about the fact that I, being in the mid part of the country, as we are in this room, am able to look left and right east and west, north and south. It's a strange thing to think, but I think about this often, that somehow, you know, living in the middle of the country makes me aware of the entire country.
And appreciative of it all.
And appreciative of how everyone is in this large landmass.
Right.
Yeah.
Let's find out a little bit about where you have been. As I just said, you were born in Delaware. You might be the first person I've ever met who was born in Delaware. I figured somebody had been born there, but
me.
Yeah, okay. What more does Delaware need? But you didn't stay in Delaware long. Drew your family from Delaware to Minnesota?
Really, it was my father's line of work. He was a food chemist. And in his PhD thesis was actually brings us refrigerated dough, because he discovered how to refrigerate and revive yeast. So when I was born in Delaware, my father worked for DuPont Company in Wilmington. Who doesn't? But then he was brought to Chicago to take part in food experimentation for the Korean War.
Oh.
So powdered eggs. Yummy.
Yeah,
and
right.
And then he was recruited as director of research at the Pillsbury Company, which is in Minneapolis.
Right.
So that's how we all came there and remained there.
You, your parents, and your sisters.
And my sisters, yes.
So I have read that some of your first musical experiences were actually because of the piano lessons that one of your older sisters was taking.
Right.
Tell us about that.
Right, right. The rule in my family was you could take piano starting at age 7, but not before. And my two older sisters at age 7, they each began piano. And I just so wanted to play the piano. So I would stand next to the piano. I was not very tall, looking down the keyboard as their hands moved on the keyboard, and basically practice with them, but only in my mind.
Wow.
Yeah, and then when they were done practicing, I would climb up onto the keyboard, the bench, which, by the way, I still own, that particular bench.
Really?
Yes, and then then make up pieces, and then ask my parents what they thought of the music that I made up.
Oh, wow.
They were very tolerant.
It would be interesting to know what that rule about age 7 was all about. Did you ever ask them what was going on in their minds?
I did not. Our family lived and died by the rules that my father wrote down in a little notebook. You know, in my case, I think it probably was a good rule, you know, because I wanted to so much.
Well, right.
You know, that I did, but in my brain, which is, of course, ear training, which every great musician must do.
Right.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I suppose in some ways that stoked your
intense
interest and desire to do it. And once you could start taking piano, you probably appreciated it on a whole different scale.
I certainly did.
Wow.
Yeah.
you had an interesting early musical education that included certain influences that would probably be maybe a little bit of a surprise to people listening to this, for instance. I mean, we don't hear traces of Gregorian chant in a song like this, but I know that Gregorian chant was important to you in some of your education.
Yes.
First of all, in what setting were you encountering something like Gregorian chant, and what kind of difference did it make?
Well, the grade school that I attended, which is now called Carondelet, and when I went was Christ the King, on 50th and York in Minneapolis, was populated by the Sisters of Carondelet, St. Joseph's Sisters, and they were practicing the medieval quadrivium as a way of preparing the brain for the logics of an educated brain. How it translated to us was that every child in first grade learned to read and write music, not for the purpose of performing it, but for the purpose of educating the brain to think in music. At the same time that we were educating the brain to think in arithmetic, you know, and in letters. And so we all, for 8 years, read and wrote music every day.
Wow.
And we sang Gregorian chant starting in third grade, but we could read it, you know, because we could read. I didn't understand how really important that was until I reached high school. I went to a public high school with a public music education in the manner that we teach, realized that in fact I could read, and most of my colleagues in the choir, they couldn't read; they were illiterate.
You mean in terms of reading music or sight reading music particularly?
Yep. And so I was immediately put in the choir as the head of the second soprano section. I'm thinking it's because I could read and tune,
And find those inner
and
voices.
And find those inner voices, but I was already writing by that time also because I could read and write.
Wow.
I just had a gift that just matched up with that training. And I started writing in sixth grade, and I've been composing ever since.
Wow. What were your first efforts as a composer? I mean, were you writing songs for yourself to sing, for instance, or other kinds of things?
Both instrumental and vocal. So I was writing piano pieces on black keys, because my fingers could dip. And I had some piano training at that point. So I would be writing instrumental pieces for piano and then vocal works. But the vocal works, usually when I'm looking at a young composer's vocal works, they deal with subject matters that are important to adolescents, usually broken hearts or anger. But I was interested more in the rhythm of words. So Spanish, I was also taking Spanish at that time, and I loved the rhythmic content of Spanish, such as pollito. That's a, you know, it's a chick, but in American English, it's a chick. Right. And in Spanish, it's pollito.
A little more melodious,
and so I was really writing rhythmic word songs, and also my form of opera. Because I in sixth, seventh, and eighth grade, we made up an opera which we performed on the playground at the school where I went, and it allowed us to cross the forbidden boundaries, which our playground was divided into the girls' side and the boys' side, which was fine up until about sixth grade, but then, of course, more interaction is desired. So I invented an opera called The Elements, and each of us who were an element, you could be wind or fire, you had your own leitmotif. And when you uttered your leitmotif, then the other elements could just come and be with you. Boundaries, not important.
Wow, so I like that.
That went on for about 3 years.
Wow. Now, and you, for instance, called a work like that an opera? I mean,
Yes, I did.
It's not like in retrospect you realized, you know, that was an opera I wrote back then. I mean, how did you, for instance, even know what opera was? Had you encountered it first person at that point?
Yes, as a matter of fact. In the Twin Cities, there's a rich cultural life. So I had encountered ballet, I had encountered Broadway musical, and I'd also encountered opera. And I knew that opera in my soul. I just wrote a foreword, actually, for a journal about what is opera, you know, and that it is, opera is a fully sung chant for a person, an audience member, to dwell for a long period of time in an abstract, essential human emotion. So grief, you know, love, death, greed,
Right.
But to dwell in that emotion.
Immerse yourself.
And that's quite different than Broadway.
Right.
Agreed. Closer to Shakespearean.
Wow. These early efforts when you were beginning in sixth grade, from the start, were you writing them down? I mean, was this music that you were notating? Because sometimes people who first dabbled in composition never even occurs to them to actually write anything down. And the notating of it can be sometimes the hardest part or the most laborious part. Were you transcribing, I mean, notating fully these early compositions?
I did, not the opera, but everything else, yes. And it's because I could read and write. So it wouldn't occur to me not to write something down, at that point in time, except for this improvised, always changing opera. Now that's come together in my work, that some things are improvised now, and some things are written down, and in several pieces, one that we're working on during this festival, it's a combination of written down and then improvised.
Ah.
Yeah.
Wow. We'll have to hear more about that. For those of you just joining us in the morning show today, we are honored to have with us in the studios composer Libby Larson, Grammy Award-winning composer Libby Larson, who is here at the invitation of Carthage's Music Department, and specifically Dr. James Ripley, the coordinator or director of instrumental activities. She is the headliner for the 14th annual Lakeside Band Festival at Carthage, and the event culminates in a very exciting concert Saturday night that will feature all or most music of Libby Larson.
We're fortunate to be able to play a number of Ms. Larson's works, but we also are including some selections by Stephen Paulus. Steve was actually in our process to bring on campus for the Lakeside Band Festival at such a time that he agreed to do that, but then unfortunate circumstances arose in his life that's not a possibility. But we're also honoring Steve by having a few of his pieces played as well.
Oh, I'm glad. So glad. We'll get to his name in a moment, because I know the two of you collaborated on something very important. So you went off to college with aspirations of studying composition and so on?
When I went to the University of Minnesota, I was going to pursue a double major, one in economics.
Ah.
If then propositions, turns out that's good for composition too.
And, yeah.
Or I wanted to be an opera star. because at that time, reading and writing music was just natural. And and no one had ever pointed out the fact that I was doing this as anything special. So the idea of being a composer was one that I discovered my sophomore year in college.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So up to that point, it was just for fun, like some people collect stamps or some people paint pictures, and you were just creating music and didn't think of it as that kind of a vocation, potentially.
No, I didn't. And not in retrospect, I realized there are circumstances that, were working then that it wouldn't have occurred to me to be a professional composer.
So why did it occur to you then? What happened your sophomore year? Did the lightning bolt come from the sky?
It did. Yes, it was in a music theory class. I loved music theory. I just was like a duck to water.
Mm.
Yeah, not all of my peers felt that way.
Surprise, surprise.
And so I can see it in my mind. I can see the classroom in Scott Hall at the University of Minnesota. My instructor was talking about something, and of course my mind was wandering. And it was a bolt of lightning. It said, I can do this. I can compose music, and that can be what I do with my life. And it's really true. And then I thought, oh, well, I'm a composer. Because I was heartbroken because I'd proven to myself that I was not of a professional quality to be the Met star that I wanted to be.
Yeah.
But I do write a lot of vocal music out of that desire.
So generally speaking, at least, has composition been your sole avocation? I mean, I don't remember reading your biography if you had, 10 years where you dug ditches or something.
Yeah.
Just about from the get-go, have you been able to live as a composer?
Sometimes quite frugally.
Sure.
But, I also have an administrative bent. I like to administrate things. which makes sense for a composer of large-scale works because you're doing a lot of administrating on the page. But when I was a grad school in grad school at the University of Minnesota, there were about 11 of us who were 12 of us who were pursuing the idea that we would be composers. And so Steve Paulus and I, who we always had coffee together and ate sticky buns and, you know, kept each other, you know, supported in our work, we got to talking and then started talking with our peers about what we needed to do in order to pursue the vision of being professional composers. At that time, it looked like all you could do if you were studying composition that deeply was to become a professor. For a number of reasons, we all felt that that probably wasn't the route. Most of it was because tenure, and most of the teachers in their 40s had tenure. So, but we started an organization, a forum, for ourselves to discuss what we need and then do something about it.
Right.
Produce concerts, make recordings, raise funds, learn how to act in a professional business manner, those kinds of things.
Right. So that was the Minnesota's Composers Forum, which became the American Composers Forum.
Yes, yeah.
So when you began, how many of you were there that were part of that?
We thought it was just going to be a group from the graduate school at University of Minnesota. However, we found really quickly, as we spread the word around that we were making this forum, there maybe were 30, 35 of us in those first couple of years, because we were so naive. You know, it didn't occur to us that that there were professional composers in the community, many who were holding positions as church music directors, rock and roll people, people who are making music and calling themselves composers. Our organization then, as it is now, is open to any genre of music, any kind of music.
Mm. So even if you're writing jingles.
Jingles, I mean, yeah. Fine. Kurt Pilhofer, for a matter of fact, that might be a name you know or don't know, was an early member of the forum, as was Stanislav Skoroczewski, who was the music director at the Minnesota Orchestra, never defined as a composer. So what we did in defining ourselves as professional composers defined a community. Mm. We didn't know we were doing that, but it was so exciting to suddenly know that there was this community, and hardly anyone, none of the professors from the University of Minnesota joined, and still didn't.
Interesting,
isn't it though? Yeah, you know, self-selecting. It was self-selecting,
right.
Which is, of course, the American way.
Yeah, right. We're speaking with composer Libby Larson, who is the special guest of Carthage for their 14th annual Lakeside Band Festival, which is going on this week. And the culminating event is an exciting concert Saturday night that will largely feature her music. So Libby Larson, let's find out a little bit about how you have over the years sort of functioned as a composer, the sort of the nuts and bolts of your creative process. Of course, particularly now, it's a situation where people come to you and say, please write me a song cycle. Here's a check for such and such.
Right.
Or please write us a symphony or a whatever. In the early going, when it wasn't quite that situation, what were your sources of inspiration and sort of what were the nuts and bolts by which your music got created?
My mind is very active, and it's always listening and seeking, and I think in music first. Before I think in words, I hear my way into the world. So deep listening all the time, which sounds like very intense thing to do, but it's not. It's just hearing things. So in the early days, a typical request, and it always requests. I suppose it's because I was already prolific, you know. So there was a trust that there actually would be a peace.
Right, there's no lack of ideas.
Right, yeah. No lack of ideas. But there was lack of money. So a friend of mine who was giving his doctoral recital in Oregon at the University of Minnesota asked if I would contribute a piece to that, which is of course a delightful request, and he said, "What do you want? You know, in return, I don't have any money, you know." But he was respectful of the process. That in fact, there is an exchange of time and goods and what have you.
Right.
So I asked him for a case of Mars bars. and received that,
okay.
Which was quite delightful.
There you go.
Many of the studio professors at the University of Minnesota, Jeffrey Van, guitarist, Vern Sutton, head of the opera program, vocal faculty, would ask me for pieces for their faculty recitals, which I, of course, you know, I can learn at the feet of great master performers. The exchange there is that they would perform. They would perform the works, and there would be a quality, you know, audience and a quality effort, that I totally respect it. But then there does come a time when you actually need to have some money.
Right.
So I think one of the other great joys of starting the American Composers Forum, the Minnesota Composers Forum, is we all gave each other courage. To be professional and ask for an exchange of, you know, goods and money, and it became actually quite easy after that, because we established a professional relationship with whoever was wanting some music.
Right.
Yeah.
As you're describing some of these early years, I'm reminded of advice given to me by the great Alice Parker.
Oh, who I just saw last week.
Oh, is that right? I'm glad she's still around.
She is.
Alice Parker, the longtime composer in residence for the Robert Shaw Chorale. She came to Carthage in the early 1990s, and we took turns on the faculty taking her out for meals, and so my wife and I took her out for supper, and it was my wife who screwed up the courage to ask her, for a young composer, and she kind of inclined her head towards me, what would be your advice in terms of a composer, in a sense, sort of finding their footing, their own voice?
Yeah.
And her advice was, write for people you know. Go to the high school in your community and go to the choir director and say, I will gladly write you a piece, you know, for free. I mean, instance, and or write something for your own church choir or for a singer you admire, but respond to a specific voice or a specific group, a specific setting, versus trying to write a great piece of music that the whole universe will fall in love with, because then chances are the music you'll write will be very generic and not your own, and you'll actually find your own voice when you are thinking in that kind of collaborative spirit. And I think that's the best advice I ever got. And I suspect that you have found, I'm sure you found that in these instances you're describing now,
yes.
And even probably in this sort of newer reality of commissions, sometimes from complete strangers, that still there is that sense that you are responding to someone and to something tangible that sparks a different kind of creative energy from you, I should think.
It is true. And Alice Parker gave you great advice, you know, because music is a communication of soul to soul, you know, and heart to heart, and very human and very real. And it is true. All of the early years that we were just talking about, I knew who I was working with, and they knew me, you know, which is... So we knew each other's energy. And to this day, if I can, I want to meet face-to-face and be in the energy of the musicians that I'm composing work about and for. It's becoming harder these days because we have the Internet. And it is possible now to work on a commission and never actually even speak to a person.
Or be in the same room with
them,
at least.
Or be in the same room with them. You know, it's possible to not know anything other than what's being communicated by this very limited communicative device, which is the screen. Mm. You know, this screen is not communication.
Right.
You know, it's just a transmitter of idea.
Right.
Yeah. And
not quite the same.
Not quite the same. So now I ask, can I come and work with you? Mm. You know, I'd really like to be in the room with you. Mm. And in general, people are surprised by that, but also say yes. Mm. You know, so that the process can be what the process is, which is human to human.
Right. Yeah. At the risk of making something quite complex very simplistic, I often like to ask composers when we're in this situation, if you consider yourself more of a Mozart or more of a Beethoven, in the sense that Mozart was renowned for dashing off his music in very seamless fashion. I mean, hardly crossing out anything. It just seemed to just pour out of his brain. And, of course, for Beethoven, it was a much more tortured process. Mm-hmm. And his wastebasket, in a sense, was full to the brim most of the time. I mean, mm-hmm. he had to really wrestle with his ideas, wrestle them into submission, and with varying degrees of success, but nevertheless, an equal genius, but a genius who worked in a very different way.
Right.
Are you closer to one or the other in terms of your own creative process?
Very much closer to Mozart.
Ah.
Very much. My process is really inside my head, so all the discontinuous thinking that comes together in the head to make an inspired moment, says you're going to be a piece of music. You know, that's all in my head, and then I think and think and think about the idea, and generally need a deadline so that I can make some decisions. Really, we're wrestling with infinity. So when I sit down to write, I usually pretty much write the piece out. More like Mozart.
But so in a sense, you delay the moment of writing anything down until much has happened
inside the head. Yes,
wow.
I do. Yep, absolutely.
I know that, I know you best as a composer of art songs and operas, and I think for a while that's the way the world knew you best. But now when I look at your list of works, it's clear that you're across the genres and write stupendous music for instruments. I wonder if you could just say a word about how different it feels to compose music when there is no text, since you are somebody who, I mean, as I witnessed yesterday in your coachings with some of our singers, you're someone who cherishes text, appreciates it on such a profound level. What's it like then to write a tuba concerto or something like that where there is no text in a sense, or not in the most direct sense of the word? And does it feel like in some ways, a completely different exploit than responding to text?
Well, yes and no. So responding to text, I already have words that have meaning. You know, and then I deal with that meaning by using musical language. So that's the yes in responding to text. But no, it's not different in untexted, because in my mind, it's the language of the music that I'm most interested in. Is what are the linguistic possibilities of music, meaning pitch, motion, shape, and emotion. There's a piece that we are going to be performing. We could call it a tuba concerto, but I call it Ursa.
Oh, yeah.
For Ursa Major. And the tuba, in my mind, is a bear. No, even though it doesn't sound like, well, in one spot it sounds like. Yeah.
There are some growlings.
But, yeah.
But tasteful growlings.
Yeah. Tasteful growlings. yes, when Ursa is singing to the moon. Yeah. Oh, the moon again. Yeah. It's musical language that is the through line, whether I'm writing for text, with text, or untext.
Interesting. So you're always thinking of language even when there aren't, in a sense, actual words.
Yes, correct.
Wow, fascinating. Yeah. Well, we happen to have off of your website IRSA. Yeah, and I should have called it that.
No.
Forgive me. And what was it that you thought we should play from this?
The second movement where the bear is cavorting around at midday. So there's the first movement that presents a singing to the moon at night, but then there's some lovely little nighttime music at the end of that, and then all of a sudden we're into daybreak, and at midday the bear now has his chance to stroll around.
Okay, well let's hear a little bit of this at high noon from IRSA. That is fun. This is just a little taste of At High Noon, the second movement of IRSA, a work for tuba and wind ensemble. This is one of the pieces that's going to be played on Saturday night's concert. This would probably be as good a time as any to briefly talk about the other things that are going to be featured on Saturday night's concert by Libby Larson.
Sure. Happy to bring that to the audience. The band festival will have a select group of high school musicians from around the area that will be rehearsing and having a chance to meet Libby during the day and talk about her music. And that group will be performing a delightful work called Hambone, which is built out of African-American traditions, but includes some hand-clapping things that are just really, really fun. Then they'll also be doing the two pieces by Steve Paulus, a piece called Three Moods, and then another work called Mosaic. The band festival group and our wind orchestra will actually join together to play River Fanfare, which is a piece that thankfully Libby allowed me to arrange for wind band. Originally it was written for the Sheldon Theater Brass Band in Red Wing, Minnesota. And so this is now a chance to put that piece with a large setting, which I'm looking forward to. And then the wind orchestra, the college band, will be playing the IRSA, as well as a wonderful piece called An Introduction to the Moon. And that will be the piece that we've been talking about that intersperses written music with poetic images that also have improvised music behind it and some visual elements as well. So it's quite a piece.
So what's it feel like to arrange something composed by the great Libby Larson? Isn't that scary?
It's
not that Libby Larson is scary, but boy, I'd be scared to death to.
It's always tricky. And we've had, I think it's the same thing sometimes as composing, though. I mean, you just have an interchange with the person that you're working with to make sure that the ideas are what collaboratively you want to come out. And so I asked her for some guidance on a couple of spots, and she was good enough to say, well, yeah, do this, but let's not do this. So that's just kind of how that works. I've had the good fortune to work with Morton Gould on an arrangement and some other kinds of
Southeast and South Central Wisconsin Emergency Alert System. In the event of an emergency, this system would bring you important information. This test is now concluded.
So it's happy to be able to work with any of the composers on their arrangements. So many times it's someone that's passed, and you're working with material that's already existed, and you don't have a chance to check. So it's actually better when you are working with a living composer, because then you can really get at the heart of the matter.
Ah, I bet that's fun for you.
It is, very much.
Good.
But it's still a little scary tonight because we're going to play it for the first time.
Oh, boy. All right. Well, we'll hope she likes it. And the concert is when, Saturday night?
7 p.m.
7 p.m.
We start at 7 o'clock. Right.
Which is a beautiful space for wind ensemble. Libby Larson, I want to ask you about something that springs out of a personal experience I had earlier this year when I actually wrote my own first opera.
Wow, it was, congratulations.
It was kind of a wild adventure. It's because our opera workshop was going to do Puccini's Sur Angelica, which has only women, and we had all these wonderful guys and couldn't find anything that's for just guys that would work for their, you know, ability level and so on. And weirdly, the best solution was to create something new. And fortunately, the stage director, Matt Barresi, is a very experienced librettist. So we ultimately came up with the idea for the Munich Olympics and that tragedy. So this opera called Black September. The only reason I bring it up is because I had this extraordinary experience of really for the first time in my life. I've written lots of things for my church, but it would usually be my words or words from the Bible or words I had selected. This was the very first time that I was being emailed words that I didn't know and was entrusted with setting to music. And it was one of the scariest things because I thought, what if I get these words and they mean nothing to me? What if no music springs from them? And actually, it's a testament to Matt's beautiful words that I had this uncanny feeling like the music was already there. I was just like excavating or uncovering music. I didn't even have to create the music. I just wonder, when you are writing these extraordinary works that are settings of poetry, if you ever have that experience as well, that sometimes it's as though the music is already in the text, or often is it more difficult? Is it there's various musics that could emerge and you need to figure out the one that is the most effective? I mean, typically, what is your relationship to the texts that you set in your pieces?
Well, you just joined the community of opera composers, you know, the great crossroads of the music of you and the music of the text.
Yeah,
you know?
Then,
and they're not necessarily compatible.
Right.
The struggles throughout history of with librettists and composers. But you had the happy circumstance of working with a librettist who brings music to the text.
Right, exactly. Who thinks in those terms right from the beginning.
Right, so the text just sings off the page to you. I am a voracious reader. I just read and read and read. Poetry, prose, newspaper ads, whatever, uses words. And I look for texts that sing off the page.
You'll hear
what
a great
lot of
phrase.
Us talking about coming across a poem that just sings off the page, so that the music is there. But I've also had the experience of working with a libretto a couple of times, actually, where it's just not singing. And so then the work becomes less joyous and more laborious.
Yeah, I can imagine.
to understand where the twain can meet, you know, that can my music meet and marry the text, which often means collaborating even more with the librettist to try to find the marriage of the two, because it hasn't been a happy dating so far.
Right, exactly. I recently interviewed over the phone Robert Aldridge and Herschel Garfein.
Yeah.
We had an interesting conversation, especially with Mr. Garfein, the librettist for the new opera that the Florentine just did, Sister Carrie, because he himself is also a composer. But in this case, he was just the librettist. And I asked him, you know, creating these words, isn't it weird to write these words and then hand it off to somebody else to create the music? And he said, actually, no. When I'm wearing the hat of a librettist, That's just, it's just like a different part of my soul. But he's thinking as a composer. He's just not creating the actual music. He's leaving that for somebody else to do.
Right, right, right. And then there's the issue of the libretto, which I know you dealt with too, is does it have stagecraft in it?
Yes.
You know, is this librettist a person of the theater, understanding that you don't need a lot of words?
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. Sometimes fewer is better.
Fewer is better. Fewer is better. Right. Understanding that you don't sing, "Pass me the milk, please." you know, just one of the characters hands somebody a glass of milk.
Right. Let's get on with it. Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
Show, don't tell.
Right. So in just the last couple minutes we have, do you feel like at this stage in your life that the creation of music, your life as a composer, is dramatically different from what it was way back when you, your good friend Stephen Paulus and you were first sort of embarking on this adventure? I mean, is your soul fed in different ways? Are you confronting different challenges? I mean, or does this very much feel like the same adventure it's been from the start?
You know, it does feel like the same adventure. You know, classical composers in America are marginalized. We work in the margins because we're being compared to Mozart or Beethoven, right?
Yeah, whoops.
you know, so it's the same adventure, and it's always exciting because it's always pioneering, which I really enjoy that part of the work that I do, is to just continue saying something authentic, you know, in public through music. But I, of course, am an older and wiser girl, my own musical language has changed quite a bit over these breathless past 40 years.
Well, that makes it fun for you, too, and for those of us who enjoy your music so much.
Yes, and that's not something that I can control, actually. It just, the muse just says, now we're going to look at this, and now we're going to look at that. So I've had a partner the whole time on this ride, you know, which is my creative self.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's been wonderful. And I hope for another 30.
Yeah, we all hope so, too. Well, in the meantime, on behalf of everyone who appreciates your music, we want to thank you for being here. And certainly Carthage is grateful to have you here for the 14th Annual Lakeside Band Festival. We want to remind everyone that the concert is Saturday night at 7 o'clock at Siebert Chapel. And all kinds of wonderful works will be performed that night, many of them by Libby Larson, some by her good friend, the much-missed Stephen Paulus. And Libby Larson, Dr. James Ripley, I want to thank both of you most sincerely for joining me today on The Morning Show. I have enjoyed every minute of this.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you, Greg. Our pleasure.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we talk music again with Nick Berutian, who is the founder and artistic director of the Bell Ensemble of Racine. This weekend, they're going to be performing an interesting work by German composer Hugo Distler called Totentanz, or Dance of Death. And we will be talking with him tomorrow about that. Also, we'll be hearing from Dr. James Kinchin from the University of Wisconsin Parkside, the director of choral activities there. Then I'm afraid we turn from music to politics on Friday's morning show. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock, and you'll find the programs, including this interview today, archived on the website WGTD.org. Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support also comes from Carthage College, inviting you to become part of the studio audience for the last Beyond the Beltway nationally syndicated radio broadcast to air before the election. The program will be produced